it moved on to the story of, as another whole story of Dr. Eric Walker, who was the president of Penn State University, and that Wilbur Smith led us. There was a very definite trail that confirmed to us that the material we were getting was for real, because it actually led the people. You could actually track down, and those people led to other people.
Yeah.
And then when you assumed that we were told those people knew what was going on, we got to, for example, Dr. Eric Walker, who was former president of Penn State University for 17 years, and we were told this guy was there with the word go. This guy was one of the main people who helped create the secrecy established around this. He knew all the top people, all the military people. He had 14, 15 year honorary doctorate degrees. He dealt with presidents. And we went through his thing, and his thing led to the presidents. And that's where I've spent probably the last 5 or 6 years working on the presidents and trying to figure out, what does the president know, and is the real story there? Okay, if you can find out what the president knows, he should know everything, and that will be the true story, not the disinformation that they put out. This will be the true story of what is actually going on.
Okay, wow, all right. Covered a lot of ground there. Thanks.
Yeah.
Wow. That sounds like a lot of fascinating avenues for research, especially the Wilbur Smith stuff.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard too much about him yet, so I'll definitely be checking that out. Now, you got into ufology in the 70s in Canada, and obviously you follow what's going on here in America because we're so close nation-wise.
Yeah.
Well, how would you say the ufology, I don't want to say scene, but the ufology field in Canada is compared to America? Is there less going on up there?
A lot less. Yeah. What happens in Canada is you don't have the crash flying saucer stories. You don't have the conspiracy stories. You don't have the government stories. You basically have people working on sightings. And there are some very prominent people, Chris Rakowski, who is at the University of Manitoba, where I am. And they work on a lot of sightings. They file sightings and stuff. And I really don't have much to do with that because, as I said, right from the word go, I sort of established that sightings really wasn't getting us very far. I was always interested in sort of proving to my friends and neighbors that this thing was for real. And I figured, well, if I could find out what the government knew, I could get a document and actually prove to them, look, they, you know, shove it in their face and say, here it is, here's the truth.
Yeah.
So I sort of moved in a different direction, but there are a lot of people all across Canada who file these sightings. They're very meticulous about this. They're all put together. They're on databases. And but you don't have the crash saucer stuff. You don't even have the government stuff. I had always said that in Canada, if you were to say to me, well, who in the government runs the thing, I would have no idea. I have absolutely no idea what department it would be in. And in fact, Chris Rakowski, who's here at the University of Manitoba, basically runs when the government gets a sighting, they basically send it to him. Really does appear that the Canadian government really couldn't care less about this, that they really don't know. And you get stories like, I don't know how familiar your listeners are with Canadian politics, but there was just recently a disclosure conference that occurred at the University of Toronto.
This is with Hellyer, right?
With Paul Hellyer. I'd known Paul Hellyer's story because Paul Hellyer had told the Wilbur Smith story. He had told a story, and he's famous as being the Secretary of Defense for 4 years under Prime Minister Lester Pearson. And Lester Pearson was a guy who won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Okay.
He was Prime Minister of Canada in the mid-1960s, and he was also very interested in UFOs. He'd asked for a UFO briefing. We know this from documents. And Paul Hellyer, as Defense Minister, was the guy who had prepared the UFO briefing. And Hellyer was pretty honest about what was going on. He's very open. He says, this thing's for real. He read the Corso book. He believes this is for real. He was told by a general in the United States it's for real. But when it came right down to it, he said when he was the defense minister, he got UFO sightings, but he basically ignored them. And it sort of indicated that there really was, and Secretary of Defense is one of the guys who, if there was a conspiracy, if there was a cover-up, this is one of the guys that would be involved. And he basically, and I believe him, that he really didn't have much to do. And it was almost like either nothing's going on or they contracted everything to the Americans. They basically just, you have people in the field who are able to alert military to what's going on in the Americans' command. And there was a story told about that seemed to sort of give you an example about this. And this was the same radar technician that told me about this, about a U-2, and this is 1959, and we've now confirmed the story. We've got the photographs and stuff. There was a U-2 coming over the North Pole, coming from Russia, and that it was going to crash. It was coming down. They knew it was a U-2 based on its flight pattern, and that my father's office, there was the accident investigator, went out and went and told my father the story. He went out, and this was way up north, sort of in the middle of nowhere, on the Manitoba-Saskatchewan border, and he had arrived there, and the Americans had beat him to the site. The Americans were there. They had a bunch of military, Marine-type people, and the Canadian accident investigator went and said, I'm coming through, I'm the accident investigator, and this black Marine had stuck a rifle in his stomach and said, you better turn around and walk away. And he said, no, I'm an accident investigator. This is Canadian sovereign territory. You have no right to be here. I'm the accident investigator. I'm going to investigate. And he said, sorry, sir, I'd advise you to turn around and walk away. And the guy really realized he's going to get shot, so he turned around and went back to Winnipeg, was very furious, and he worked for the government. He made a phone call to Ottawa, to the nation's capital, to the Department of Transport, and said, these goddamn Americans are here. They think they own everything. They won't let us on the site. This plane has crashed. We have the right to go in there. And they said, well, hang on. We'll phone you back. They phoned him back an hour later and said, I think you better let the Americans just do what they want to do. And that was the end of the story. And I think that may be what happens in ufology, is that basically the Americans come in, they have a lot of ways of being alerted when something crashes or something happens,
yeah.
And they have their own special forces who have been given permission indirectly by somebody high up in the military to come in and recover. They can say it's a U-2, they can say it's an SR-71, make up whatever story they want, and they have access to go in there and recover the thing. But I really can't see any indication that anybody in the Canadian government knows what's going on. Although now I'm starting to wonder about the American government, because some of the latest material I have researched, and we're working on this with the Clinton administration, that Bill Clinton, and probably your listeners don't know, I had done an extensive amount of research on the Clinton administration to try to figure out what presidents know, and there was a number of people inside the Clinton administration who were very interested in UFOs. There was a lot of people on the outside who were making overtures to the Clinton administration. Lawrence Rockefeller, one was Stephen Greer. There was a whole pile of people, and what I basically did, and if people had questions about what Greer was saying or what these people, everybody's veracity and what people were saying, I basically just took everybody's story and assumed this is all for real, and basically got names. Who were they talking to inside the Clinton administration? This sort of stuff, because the Clinton administration files are now going to be released in January of this coming year, January the 20th. I have approximately 100 of Freedom Information Act requests ready to go.
Nice.
It will be filed that night at midnight at the library. I've already talked to the library. I've been to the library. And the files, the president gets 5 years to work on his own files for memoirs and stuff. Then the files become public. And the way they open presidential files now is first come, first serve. If you happen to have the first 100 questions and they're UFO questions, that's what they're going to do. They're working on economy type stuff. That's what they've been given the mission. But starting January 20th, first come, first serve. So I'm going to be first in line, and I'm going to have my things in there. And I know all the names of the Clinton people. I know who was involved. I know the requests they were given. And I know the Clinton administration was extremely interested, and that they were shut off. And what has happened in the last month is that Bill Clinton made a speech which got no coverage. I mean, it's like ufology, sometimes we're our own worst enemies. A major story happens and nobody knows about it because people are basically, it's a hobby. There's real no coordination in the UFO community. People don't really work together. And here you had Bill Clinton making a speech in Hong Kong, and this would be about a month ago, makes a speech in Hong Kong where he basically stands up and says, I went after the flying saucer thing. I went after the Roswell story.
Oh, wow.
I tried to figure this thing out, and I was turned away. And then he made a stunning statement which says, I'm probably not the first president who's been kept in the dark.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And so here you have a situation where the president of the United States, former president, stands up and says, I tried to get the UFO story, and I was denied access, which is an unbelievable statement, because if this is true, and there's no reason, it confirms everything that I, in years of research with the Clinton people, and all the stories I heard about the Clinton was that they tried to get the story, and they had been denied access.
Yeah.
If this is true, the president of the United States does not run the country. It's a dramatic, dramatic story that Clinton would actually even confirm it and say, I'm probably not the first president who's kept in the dark, as if you can do all the voting down in the United States you want and do whatever you want to do, and you're wasting your time because the president doesn't run the country. There's somebody running the country. rather than the president. And this is a story that I thought was dramatic, and I figured this would, you know, explode. And basically, it didn't go anywhere. It was published by one Asian newspaper. I talked to the reporter who filed it, and then she said I wanted to actually have the words on tape. And she said I destroyed the tape when I transcribed it, and I have been unable to get the Clinton people. I've still not really gotten any the actual transcript, or I've got the transcript, but I haven't got the actual audio of the incident or the video. But here you have a situation where only one newspaper picked it up. Nobody else picked it up. In the UFO community, it ran on UFO updates, and there was no comment on it. It was as if this thing didn't happen. And I'm thinking this is probably the most dramatic UFO incident
in
years. And nobody picked up on it, and people couldn't care less. They're talking about sightings. They're talking about, you know, who does what to who and who's talking, and it's just stupid stuff we argue about. And it was significant. So now I'm starting to think, like I wrote an article that talked about the 64 reasons why the government's keeping it secret, and now this moves up very high on the list that maybe the number one reason the government is keeping it secret is the government has no idea what's going on. That you and I know more than the government knows. That there may be some cabal somewhere deep inside the government who has taken over this thing. But basically, if it comes down to it, you take a look at a number of situations. When I start looking at it, it starts making more sense that you have situations where, for example, Hellyer says, as defense minister, he didn't know what was going on. You have all the Clinton people saying they tried to get the answer. James Woolsey, head of the CIA, tells Stephen Greer, how can I get at, he wanted, Stephen Greer wanted him to release the material. And according to Greer, and I believe this story is true, Woolsey said to him, how can I give access to something I don't have access to. Here you have the head of the 13 intelligence agency, the chief intelligence officer in the United States, says he doesn't have access to it. So you have this situation where either nothing's going on and we're all deluded as to what's going on here, or somebody outside the government, there's a government inside the government. That's what Clinton had said at one point. There's a government inside the government that supposedly told Sarah McClendon, a famous White House reporter, he'd said to Sarah McClendon when she said to him, come on, why don't you do what Stephen Greer, why don't you get to the bottom of this UFO thing and get something? And he said, Sarah, there's a government inside the government and I don't control it. Dramatic, dramatic statement. Now, then we couldn't confirm it because we could never really get Sarah McClendon to actually say on the record, say on audio that she'd been told this by Clinton. But now we have Clinton actually saying it in person in Hong Kong a month ago, confirming the story that there's a government inside the government and the president of the United States does not control it.
So at what point do you think the UFO secret got out of the hands of the president?
Well, the rumored story, when I look at that, the president's, rumored story always was that Nixon sold it to the military industrial complex. That they shut down Project Blue Book in 1969 when Nixon was in there, and they made sort of a deal that they would hand it over, the research would move over to the military industrial complex and the technology and stuff, and that was the best place to put it. That was always the rumored story. Seems to sort of be true, and there was a story that I've done, I probably more research than anybody, and that's the story of the Holloman Air Force Base film. And this happened under Richard Nixon, and it was sort of the fact that not only did they then take over control of the technology over to companies like Boeing or SAIC or places like this, but they start to build a story, and this is something that ufology, I think, has missed the boat on this, and I've lectured on it a number of times, and that is the fact that the government has released stuff. If we say there's a big cover-up going on, that there's they're trying to keep it secret, it's not true. They are releasing the story, but they're releasing it on their schedule and based upon what they want you to know. For example, the prime example is a number of examples of, for example, Close Encounters of the Third Kind being an actual incident. That there's a rumored story was that Steven Spielberg had been leaked the story about the Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and he, through his movie, released this indirectly to the public.
Yeah.
A story that we know for a fact, it absolutely was leaked by the government, and that is the story of Robert Emmenegger, who's a good friend of mine. I've dealt with him numerous times. I've interviewed him. I have almost every audio he's ever done. I've heard his story 100 times. He tells the same story. It's a true story. He was approached by a colleague of his, Alan Sandler, who was a sort of did military research documentaries for the U.S. government, and Sandler had come up and said the government wants us to do some work on advanced military technology, and they were doing laser, they were doing some sort of holography and stuff, all the sort of the leading edge defense stuff.
Yeah.
And they were asked to do these documentaries for the government. They were taken to Norton Air Force Base in California, where all the audio and the video for the military is stored. And then they were taken into a secure room where the CIA used a secure room, which is soundproof. And then they were told in this secure room that they also wanted to do a documentary on UFOs. And this is a story that's always been rumored, that Walt Disney was approached and made this offer in 1955 to do a UFO documentary to acclimatize the people, to leak the story to the people. And Robert Emmeniger tells the story numerous times that they were in this room and they were given this thing, and Robert Emmeniger was a total skeptic. He thought this was total nonsense. His wife was very interested in it and read the National Enquirer and read all this stuff. He thought it was all gobbledygook, had no interest in this at all, but figured, well, okay, if the military wants to do this, we'll do a documentary. And said categorically, has told me numerous times, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about this. This was a green light. He was given access to anybody he wanted, and they all talked. There was none of this double talk, Blue Book, we didn't find anything. Basically, he was given access to all the directors of Blue Book. They basically talked to him. He interviewed Art Lundahl, who was a very famous guy at the CIA who ran the National Photographic Interpretation Center, where all the U-2, all the SR-71 photographs were analyzed. He was the guy that did the analysis in charge. Didn't do the analysis. He was in charge of the analysis on all the photographs that were done for the Robertson panel report in 1950. In the early 1950s, he was in charge of that photography. He's a photographic expert. He was also very, very interested in UFOs. He's considered one of the most important subjects in the world. He was given access to, or Emmeniger was given access, and it was at that point that Art Lundahl told the story of Francis Swan. That's where the story first leaked, by Francis Swan. It was Art Lundahl talking to Robert Emmeniger, this film producer, and telling the story about how the Navy intelligence had found this woman, and how they had the Navy intelligence guy had learned how to talk to this alpha alien, and that they had the Navy intelligence guy had been brought to the CIA and had been brought to the National Photographic Interpretation Center, where all this very high security, top secret place in the dump of Washington D.C. that had hidden there. Nobody knew what they were doing in this building, and they had gone there, and that in front of Art Lundahl and CIA people, that they had made contact with AFA, and that Art Lundahl had asked for AFA to fly by the window. We wanted proof. And that at that moment, this flying saucer flew by the window and hovered over the nation's capital of Capitol building, and that basically told the story and confirmed to Emmeniger. The story's true. It was a CIA document that had been floated around. It was released in Emmeniger's in his book that he wrote, and it was also referred to in the documentary. It's a document we now have. We just don't have the heading, the CIA heading. But Art Lundahl had agreed, yes, he had confirmed, yes, I wrote the document. The story's true. This thing flew by the window. We saw it. And the story of Francis Swan started to unravel. We would never have known the story of Francis Swan if it hadn't been for that. So the government did actually leak all this material. Emmeniger talks about a film, which was taken at Vandenberg Air Force Base, that they were given. It was a top secret film, had Quintanilla's name, one of the former directors of Blue Book, had his name on the canister, and the fact that they had this thing had been launched, and the missile was there, and these UFOs flew along the missile, and they had the film. They were going to put it in. They actually had the Holloman Air Force Base film. The Holloman Air Force Base film was a story that they had been told that he was told in May of 1971. There's also a disinformation story that it happened in April of 1964. But anyway, whenever it happened, this is a story that at Norton Air Force Base, and this is a story of close encounters of the third kind. This is a story that the Americans knew a flying saucer was going to land. They had made communication with a flying saucer, and it was all arranged. And according to what Linda Howe was told by Robert Emmeniger, they were filming from five different locations. They were filming from helicopters, they were filming from the ground. It happened at 6 o'clock in the morning. Three UFOs came into Holloman Air Force Base. Everybody knew they were coming. Two of the UFOs sort of moved away. The third came down. It was moving from side to side like it was in trouble. Landed on the tarmac at Holloman Air Force Base. High-ranking officials at Holloman Air Force Base, and all this stuff is being filmed from five different angles. High-ranking officials come. The door opens. These aliens get out of the craft. They meet with the high-ranking officials. They walk down the tarmac onto a street and into a building. And Robert Emmerich told the story that at first he was denied access to Holloman Air Force Base, and he was given a contact, and he names the guy in the Pentagon. And the guy said, okay, give me a couple minutes, and I'll try it again. So he phones Holloman Air Force Base, and the first time they said, are you crazy? You think you're coming in here? You're absolutely insane. He phoned back the second time, and they said, yeah, come on down. They showed him the building. He walked around. He filmed all this sort of stuff. He basically confirmed with people that this story had actually occurred, that he talked to the people who were involved in the filming, stuff like this. And a lot of this was confirmed. He was dealing mostly with Bill Coleman, who was a spokesman for Blue Book in the 1960s, who was a very famous UFO-type guy. And he tells a story about going into the Pentagon. He and Alan Sandler were brought to the Pentagon to review the script. This is a script that was being written by the U.S. military, by the Pentagon. And the Pentagon had to agree to what was in the script. And he said, we went there. And we walked into the, he told the story. He goes in there. They didn't have to sign in at the Pentagon. They walked right in the door. They didn't have to give their names, whatever. They walked in. Then they were met by Bill Coleman. They walked down the E-ring of the Pentagon, which is the top wing where all the generals and all the high-ranking people are on the E-wing, the E-ring. So they walk down there, they go into Coleman's office, and first they're put into a room, and some guy says to them, you know, we're upset about you guys doing UFO documentaries. People shouldn't know about this stuff. It jams up our intelligence channels. And then Sandler, the Emmenegger's associate working on the thing, said, what are you talking about? We were involved, and we were invited here by Hatch, and then Coleman, and they name all the people that have invited them there. And he said, oh, yeah, okay, just a warning. Then they go with Coleman, and Coleman gives him a warning. He says, you know, if you discover something that's classified information, you have to keep it out of the documentary. And so they're giving all these warnings, and then they said they walked into Coleman's office, and they said suddenly everything changed. Coleman started talking as if this were real. Oh, we're going to give you this film. We want this and that. And talking as if this was for real. And they said they actually had the film. They were talking about the film, and Emmenegger is going like, this is absolutely insane. He said, I was sitting there, and it was like negotiating out of the piece of film, and they're talking about aliens landing and coming out of the ship and talking to high-ranking officials. And he said, I sat there and I wondered, when is someone going to stand up and say, what the hell is going on? This is all bullshit. This is garbage. Yeah. And he said, nobody ever stood up. He said he couldn't believe it. It was like everybody was going along, and they were talking about this was like matter of fact. This happened every day in the U.S. military. And they were given the film. Emmenegger said he didn't see it. He only saw drawings of the film. The guy at Norton Air Force Base, who was Shartle, who was actually on audio and on video describing this whole thing, that he was in charge of giving out the films at Norton. And he describes what happened on the film. He saw the film. And then at the last minute, what happens, and this is how the government releases the story, at the last minute, the documentary's all ready to go. They've got all this sort of stuff. And all they have to do is insert this piece of film of the alien landing, and the UFO cover-up is broken. So they're all ready to go. And at the last minute, Coleman phones them and says, we're going to pull the film. Watergate's occurred. It's not the right time to release it. We have to pull the film. And Emmenegger says there was a guy came from the military or from the Pentagon, drove to California. He had a little tiny Honda. He and his wife piled these canisters of film into the back seat of the car, and they drove back to the Pentagon with this film. Now, this is a story. This is what they do. They give you the story, and they give you indirectly distort the dates and stuff like this. They give you the story of what happened, and then they pull the actual hardware. You don't have any bodies. You don't have any documents to prove it. You don't have any video or audio. And you can tell the stories all you want. That's what they want. They want us to tell the stories. They want us to tell what's going on because we've got nothing to prove it. So they end up telling the story through Francis Swan. They tell the story that in 1959, the U.S. military did establish contact with an alien, and that they did have contact in Washington, and this thing flew by the window. Then they tell the story that in May of 1971, the aliens actually landed at Holloman Air Force Base, and somehow indirectly they got that story to Steven Spielberg, and Steven Spielberg in 1977 releases a story on film about how it's exactly the same story.
So this is like the concept of covert disclosure that you discuss on your website, right?
Yeah, and I think this is something that they spent a lot of time doing, and I don't think, for example, that a lot of people figure that most of researchers who get involved in this sort of are written off as the fact they're making that up and they're crazy. But one of the people that I knew very well with Len Stringfield. Len Stringfield was one of the most respected ufologists that ever lived. And I knew Len Stringfield, that I would talk to him on phone, letters, and stuff like this. And
yeah.
Len Stringfield would make up a story. Len Stringfield tells a story that he was contacted, and he made the first speech. And I remember at Dayton, Ohio, he made the first speech about crash-flying saucers and about dead alien bodies. Before then, it was not in UFO literature. It had been sort of discarded with Frank Scully as being a story that had been made up, and it was a bunch of con men made up the story. And suddenly in 1977, and here's again what happens, is he's contacted by some of the figures are 200 to 300 people telling them about crash-flying saucers. This is a story, and always in the end, he could never release the names of the people, but I've never been contacted by anybody who said they were involved. Well, no, one who said that they were involved in a crash-flying saucer, they saw the bodies and stuff like that. But here's some guy who's contacted by 200 different witnesses.
Oh, wow.
It would appear to me, over a number of years, it would appear to me that they're funneling this material into him, and they're trying to control how the story comes out. They want people to know that there was a crash-flying saucer. Same story about the live alien. Emmett Egger tells a story, and I've spent a lot of time collecting the stories of the live alien. There was a lot of people, for example, Emmett Egger was offered it, Bill Moore was offered it, Richard Doty said he was involved in it, Whitley Strieber said he was offered the story, Linda Moulton Howe, the story about the live alien.
Yeah.
Linda Moulton's story about the fact that she was offered the keeper, and we actually now know who the guy was, what his name, when he died, and this sort of stuff. That she was offered an interview when he was dying of cancer in Texas in 1989, I believe it was. And here's the story, and they leaked this story, but you got nothing to prove that the government actually had a live alien. They go on in 1988, another classic story of how they allowed the stuff is the 1988 documentary UFOs Live in Washington, which was run by the Falcon, and they were leaked a bunch of stuff into that documentary, and one of the main things was the live alien. Here's a story of E.T. the extraterrestrial. Again, you have the story, the basic exact story of the live alien, and what they want people to believe is that there's been, number one, a contact in 59 and 71, a landing, and they have a live alien. They had one at the beginning, that the aliens gave them a certain amount of material, and they leak this kind of stuff, but they've got everybody in confusion. They're leaking different stories to different people.
Yeah.
They tell everybody to keep the name secret, so people are bumping into each other, figuring that the other guy's lying because they're using the wrong date.
Yeah.
And the material gets out, but the cover-up remains intact. So they have, on one hand, kept a secret because they want the military technology. They want to develop this sort of stuff. They want to take on the aliens or whatever stupid ideas they've got. And on the other hand, they are still releasing the story. They don't want people back in a 1947 mentality of not knowing anything. They want to leak the story so that if it does break, if something leaks and they can't control it, the people are somewhat acclimatized, it's not going to be as big a shock, because one of the big things, the 64 reasons, is that it's going to change the world as we know it once it is finally acknowledged by the general media or by the population that there is an alien presence here. It'll change everything. You know, Stephen Greer talks about the crash of the stock market. There's a lot of things, a lot of uncontrollable things that will occur.
So, now, what direction do you think they're going in this covert disclosure, like in the last 10, 15 years? Because you said 88, but like since then, what direction do you think it's going? I saw on your website there's a lot of, it seems like there's a lot of documents coming out now.
Yeah, I think what they're doing, because I think ufology is getting more into the conspiratorial and the documents and the underground bases and stuff, is they are basically flooding the UFO information. They're flooding the documents with bizarre stories and a lot of bizarre stuff, trying to really muddy the waters. And it may indicate that some of the truth has come out, like the Bob Lazar thing, which I think was a government setup. It was somebody picking up a guy who had a bad background, allowing him to see a few things, and then allowing him out into the public, and knowing that the UFO community would pick up the fact he had a background. So the idea that something was going on at Area 51 was released. But it sort of got people really – ufologists aren't stupid. There's a lot of people who got a lot of contacts, and they've increased the intensity of the documents that have been released. For example, if you take a look at the Majestic documents – that Bob and Ryan Wood have released, this is not a guy. This is not some rogue intelligence officer who's decided he wants to throw somebody off. This is a major effort. They're talking over 3,000 pages of documents. And I've sat with Ryan Wood a number of times, and I've looked at, even though I believe a lot of this stuff is fabrications of real documents, they've changed stuff in the documents. I'd sit with Ryan, and he would show me he's a very smart guy. They've done a lot of work on what the codes mean on these documents.
Yeah.
And he would show me things that there was no doubt about the fact that the codes that are used on the bottom of these things that mean, not even just top secret, different things that show what department it comes from, and they'd go back and check initials and be able to actually track the guy that signed the document, stuff like this, that this is an agency. This is not a person. This is an agency putting this stuff out. And 3,000 pages of material is an awful lot of material, and they've just flooded the UFO community with this stuff. And even though people will say the Majestic documents are a bunch of garbage, still the concepts that are in those documents, you can see they're gradually floating out into the UFO community. The thing about Marilyn Monroe being assassinated, about Kennedy. Now, I've done research, and the History Channel just did a documentary that was based upon my research on the presidents. And I had worked, they had sent one researcher down to the Kennedy Library, where I had never been. They went down, they brought the stuff back, and there was nothing there, which confirmed my story of the fact that Kennedy really wasn't involved at all. Kennedy wasn't interested in space. Kennedy really didn't have much interest in this whole phenomenon at all. And yet you have these stories that Kennedy tried to release the UFO information. That's why he was assassinated. That's why Marilyn Monroe was assassinated. So these type of documents are coming out to sort of use a glamorous president and really distort the whole idea of the conspiracy, to get the conspiracy people even more wound up and off track. And they're really trying to keep us, and I think they really have the situation where if a document is released, I don't think anybody believe anything, because there's so much controversy around it right now.
Yeah.
And I've always said myself that I could hardly wait for the time when someone would leak me a phony document. And I've never had the offer. I did have the one with the Douglas documents, which I don't know if you're familiar with. These were documents that I was contacted by somebody who was just using a first name, Lewis, and he said he sent me he said, and I can't remember how it happened, but anyway, he ended up giving me a document, and it was from the Douglas Aircraft Company before it became McDonnell Douglas, and this was in the 1960s, and it was a document that dealt with the fact that Douglas Aircraft was working on anti-gravity, and they were taking UFO seriously, and there was all this work. And the work was being headed up by Bob Wood, who's Ryan Wood's father. They're running the upcoming saucer conference.
Yeah.
And Bob Wood had been in aviation engineering. He'd been in this business for years. And here he was in the 1960s working for Douglas Aircraft, and they're working on anti-gravity, and he's got a project that was that had a project name to it and all this sort of stuff. And here I have a document that says Douglas Private on the cover page. And I said to the guy, okay, very interesting. And, eventually he started to leak me material. And I said, well, why would you leak this material?
Yeah.
And basically it came down to, I figured, oh, here we go. I finally got lucky and somebody's going to leak me the document. What it turned out was that one of the people who'd been working on the project had been hired to do interviews with abductees. So one of the things Douglas Aircraft under Bob Wood had determined was, let's talk to contactees and abductees and see if they can provide any inside information on what UFO technology is all about. So they had done an interview. They got a private investigator to do an interview with an abductee, and this was the guy, had all the documents. He had his own set of documents. And that he had lived in a farm, I believe it was in Washington State, and that he had died, and he had left all the documents that were found in a barn. And the person who found the documents figured, oh, this would be great. We'll get piles of money for this, and they put them on eBay. And the fellow who was leaking the documents to me bought them on eBay for $32.
Oh, man.
And here's 175 pages of documents from the Douglas Aircraft Company. Now, when I went to Bob Wood, and I said, okay, this guy's leaking me documents, and they got your name on them.
Yeah.
And they come from Douglas Aircraft. And he basically said, yeah, the story's true. These documents are legitimate. And he was very upset that this guy would leak the documents. And I said, well, and I told him the story about the eBay thing, and he was still very upset about these documents leaking. And I figured, like everything else, there's no point in keeping this thing secret. So we put them and they're now online. You can get them. I haven't got the exact address, and I don't think you can even link it. I'll probably put a link on my website where you can actually, they're all online right now. And basically, it was a private, it was like a Wilbur Smith type thing. Bob Wood was very interested in UFOs, and he'd gotten access to do UFOs for Douglas. He wanted to do some work on this, and he had gotten the okay from Douglas Aircraft, but it wasn't a Douglas Aircraft deal. It was sort of like their private thing. They were
sort of like the Wilbur Smith Observatory.
Yeah, and they were allowed to work on this sort of thing, but Douglas wasn't really backing the program.
Yeah.
You know, the documents were there. So it was one of these things where it sort of, in the end, it was very interesting documents, but it really wasn't a legitimate government document with what you're looking for. You're looking for a government document that says, yes, this thing's for real, and it's stamped, and you can actually get the track the document back and actually find it in archives. And most of the documents, they're very interesting, but you can't track them back to an archives. They sort of end up, nobody knows where they came from, and this kind of stuff, and so you can never prove it.
Yeah.
And so the government has protected that kind of stuff. They've protected the bodies, the hardware, all this sort of stuff, and they'd love us to tell the stories, and they put in extra stories to get the thing going and to distort. And what they've done, I found, is the way they've used it is to get prominent people who seem to get respect in the UFO community, and then they start feeding them the material, which does two things. It releases the material the way they want it released, and it also burns the researcher. Now, the prime example of this was Bill Moore. Bill Moore and Stanton Friedman worked on the Roswell crash, and they put out the book, and Stanton wasn't really involved, but Bill put out the book in 1979 on the Roswell crash, and it was a best-selling book. It was legitimate. It looked like this was it. They were going to break the story. He was getting a lot of publicity. He was getting a lot of interviews, and it was a hardcore thing. They had a intelligence officer from there. It wasn't the typical so-and-so and said, you know, it was they actually had names, places, dates, interviews, and here it was a crash, and it became very, very popular, and he gained an awful lot of respect. In the early 1980s, Bill Moore was one of the most respected UFO researchers in the community, and so the government was in a situation where they wanted to distort the story of Roswell, and they also needed to burn Bill Moore. And Bill Moore tells the story, and I knew Bill Moore very well when it was going on, and I basically told him that I thought he was being set up, and Bill Moore was a very smart guy, probably the smartest guy, except for Stan Friedman, the smartest guy I've ever met in ufology, knew what he was doing, was very meticulous about his research, about his interviews and stuff like this, but he had a huge ego. He figured he was the only guy who knew what was going on, and that's the way the government set him up. He was on a tour for the Roswell book, and they set him up, and they said, you know, you're the only guy in the field who knows what they're talking about. And, of course, Bill Moore took the bait. He believed this was true, so he was contacted once in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He was contacted in Omaha, Nebraska, where the Strategic Air Command base is, by there, and he was contacted by a guy at the Defense Intelligence Agency who was a high-ranking guy who knew the whole story. He was called the Falcon. It wasn't Richard Doty. It was a guy that was out of the Defense Intelligence Agency who was in his 60s at the time and had a Slavic name. We never did identify who this guy was. Bill Moore said, if you can ever name him, I'll confirm who he is. But we knew that this was going on. Basically, they started to feed him material, and they warned him. They said, a lot of this material will be disinformation. You got to weed through it yourself, and you got to determine what's real and what's not real. And they fed him a bunch of stuff, and it would be 90% true, 10% false. And Bill Moore made the mistake of releasing the MJ-12 document. They thought they had it researched. They thought they had it cleared up. They had a couple things to sort of figure out about whether this is true, whether that's true, all the names seemed to fit. And what they did, on the other hand, was they went to Tim Good, who was a major researcher in England, and they put the pressure on Tim Good. They gave him the same documents. Tim Good was coming out in his book, UFOs Above Top Secret, and he was going to release the MJ-12 document, which forced Bill Moore's hand. He had to release the MJ-12 document. He released it too soon before they'd done the actual research, and they ended up in a quagmire of people believing that Bill Moore had forged the document. That was the end of Bill Moore. He basically was wiped out. He's now no longer a researcher. Was so contaminated and destroyed by this whole story that he pulled out of the UFO thing. And that's what they do. So they'll set up, if you get a good story like Linda Howe or something, you get something, they'll come along and they'll feed you even more stuff related to what you have to distort anything that's good that you have, so that you have 10 good things, but you've got 100 pieces of information, so you can't tell and nobody else can tell what you've got that you found that was real. And that's how they do it. So they're doing two things. They're releasing the story indirectly, and they're also burning researchers so that nobody can get credibility to the point where anybody's actually going to believe them.
So how are they getting these documents out now? Are they just, like, dropping them off, or do they have, like, conduit-type characters who are, like...
Well, each story is different. For example, the Majestic documents, a lot of them were mailed, or Cooper was one of the people. His father was with the... worked for Lundahl. He worked for the National Photographic Interpretation Center, had worked on the UFO stuff on photographic interpretation. His son was very interested in UFOs, Tim Cooper. And Tim Cooper, as a young kid, he tells a story that when his father had all these people over about talking about UFOs, high-ranking people who were in the know, that he was very interested. He wanted to know these sort of stories. And later on in his life, Tim Cooper started to file Freedom of Information Act requests with the U.S. government to ask for material, and he'd file stuff. And they would send him stuff. When he would see, he'd ask for one thing, and the CIA, for example, would send him a bunch of documents with a letterhead, and not with a letterhead, but with the stamp that you could tell was actually coming from the CIA. But the minute you open the envelope, then it's over, because you can't prove that the documents came from the CIA. You can say they came from those envelopes, a sealed envelope that showed a CIA meter stamp on it.
Yeah.
But so Tim Cooper received lots of these documents, hundreds and thousands, whatever, I don't know how many of the 3,000 plus pages, but a great deal of it came through Tim Cooper. So, of course, everybody said, well, Tim Cooper made this up. One of the documents appeared to be typed on one of his typewriters, and then the UFO community, as we always do, we eat our young, we destroy our people, and everybody destroys the story and says, this guy's a totally making it up, and we head off to the next story and the next researcher that we're going to destroy, instead of looking at the fact that you may say these documents are phony, and I always look at the other side of the story. There's 3,000 pages of documents. This is not a person. This is an agency putting this stuff out. Why did someone put out 3,000 plus pages of documents? What does it mean? What do they want to tell us? What can we tell from these documents?
Yeah.
There's a story behind the story, and that's what I always look at. I'm not really interested in the document, whether it's real or whatever. I'm always trying to figure out who leaked the document and where the documents are coming from. Because if you find out where the documents are coming from, and who the person's source is, I always try to find who the source is, where these documents came from, try to filter them back, then you're going to find out who's running the show, because that's where they're coming from. And a lot of times you can sort of get close, you know it's the National Security Agency, and you know that there's a vault there, and that a lot of this stuff is being pushed out of there. You know that the president may not be involved, depending whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, but you sort of stay away from actually getting into a document and then saying, I believe this document is legitimate, the document is telling us anything. Instead, you try to get to the people who are running the show. That's basically what I try to do.
There you have it, folks. Grant Cameron, that's part one of two. Next week, we discuss more about disclosure and his attempts to get answers from candidates in political races, the 2008 election, Hillary Clinton, perhaps, being a conduit for UFO disclosure. We discuss Grant's problems at the border getting out of Canada back in September and what he thinks about it now that it's been about 2 months since it happened. And tons of other stuff, and that's going to be next week on Banal of America Audio, Season 1, November 19th, 2005. I hope you come back and check it out. I want to thank Grant for sitting down and talking to me for so long. Obviously, I want to plug his website again here, www.presidentialufo.com. This is a fantastic website. There's tons of information there. You got to check it out. You're going to be just completely blown away by all the stuff he has there and all the research he's done. I want to thank Leslie and Chiron for all your help with Banal of America Audio Season 1 in getting this series out to the people. And I want to thank all you great people out there listening today. You'll be hearing from me next week with Part 2 of 2, the Grant Cameron interview on Banal of America Audio Season 1.